Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.
Thank you for listening to this St. Louis on the Air podcast brought to you by Lindenwood University's Hammond Institute for Free Enterprise. Examining market approaches to help solve economic and social issues, Hammond.institute.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Our Legal Roundtable panel has a wide lens on issues in the legal world this month. We'll focus on some of them, ranging from the national emergency and its fallout to efforts locally to minimize the punitive use of fines and fees. Joining me in studio is our panel of attorneys. Mark Smith is Associate Vice Chancellor and Dean for Career Services at Washington University. Bill Freivogel is Professor of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. And Donna Harper is with the Sade Harper Westhoff Law Firm. Donna, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
I'd like to start, and welcome to you, gentlemen.
Oh, hi,
too.
Thanks.
I'd like to start with the national emergency. Everybody's talking about it. At least five lawsuits have been filed against the challenging the declaration that the president made a couple of weeks ago. The California Attorney General has filed a suit representing 16 states. So this thing has got a little lump to it, it would appear. And basically saying the president extended his authority and circumvented Congress to issue that emergency. President Trump has said he didn't have to do it. I didn't have to do it. Remember that at his news conference? Mm-hmm. Does that kill any defense that he has for this thing? Anybody have a thought?
I don't think it kills any defense. I mean, it contradicts that there's any kind of emergency here. But, you know, you remember back in the travel ban case, Trump had said repeatedly it was a Muslim ban, but the Supreme Court, you know, they don't really, they sort of dismissed those sort of campaign statements that were made before the election back in the travel ban case. You know, I don't think they want to get too far into Trump's statements. They'll sort of stick more with what does the emergency declaration itself says. Mm. One sort of funny thing about that is that he probably has enough money from the other pots of additional money that he has identified. He probably has enough money to do what he can do during this fiscal year anyway without even using.
Right.
He doesn't even need the emergency declaration to unlock some additional DOD money that he wants to have access to. So in a way, it probably won't have a huge amount of practical impact on how much wall gets built. I think the case itself is really hard. It's a really close case. Supreme Court back in the 50s said in this when Harry Truman tried to seize the steel mills, that the presidential emergency powers don't reach that far. And they said particularly when Congress has expressed its view contrary to what the president's trying to do, the president's powers are the weakest. But there we're talking about constitutional powers. After steel seizure, Congress in the 70s passed this law giving the president power to declare emergency. Presidents have done that many times since, I think 50 plus, but none of them have been like this one where, you know, he had already tried to get the money from Congress and Congress had very specifically refused to provide more than the $1.3 billion that they provided. So, you know, then that raises this sort of separation of powers questions. Does Congress have the power over the purse?
I wonder whether the court will even get to those issues. There's a couple of easy ways that the court could just dispose of any of these lawsuits. First, on standing grounds, do these states really have the right to bring claims along these lines? And second, until he actually tries to spend this money, there hasn't been any kind of a harm. I mean, as you point out, Bill, he hasn't even gotten to the money they gave him, what, last year? Not to mention the money they gave him this year.
Right.
So by the time he spends last year's money and maybe the money they gave him this year, these lawsuits could be easily disposed of on those grounds, I think.
I think there, two of the states are on the border, at least two, New Mexico and California, but they've said they're not building walls there.
And Texas.
Texas, okay. And then, but like New York and New Jersey and Hawaii, they don't have any. You know, so I think your argument about standing, and then the president's already said we're going to use the allocated money first. So there's a ripeness issue. Do we really have an issue? And then, you know, what Bill was talking about was the constitutional limits on the president. We've had presidents in the past who've done more egregious things. You know, Roosevelt entering the Japanese, that was under his executive powers. Lincoln,
which the Supreme Court approved.
Yeah, right. But not one of our better moments as a country.
Yeah.
And then Lincoln, you know, suspending habeas corpus. And then, and now we've got this 1976 statute that gives the president more. So I think this is probably going to go forward for both of the reasons. And then we've got this statutory kind of broad grant to the president. So
At some point, I think there will be the ability on the part of people who are affected by this to challenge this emergency declaration at some point. I think right now the easy way to get rid of it is to say it's not right.
Right, yeah.
Nobody's been harmed yet. You don't have to stick your hand down on the sofa to get that money that the Defense Department's got laying around.
Well, there are
because
a couple
you haven't spent what you've already got.
There are a couple of property holders, you know, who clearly have. Yeah, would clearly, I think, have standing.
They would only have for, I mean, then the government come back and say, I'm in a domain, and then they would just get fair market value.
Well, they're challenging.
But if it's done under the, you know, if they're moving forward under the emergency powers proclaimed by the president, they could get to that issue. I think it's very possible. I think it's very likely that somebody's going to end up with standing, and I think it's very likely that some judge, some federal judge is going to issue an emergency injunction saying the president can't move forward. And in that case, then we end up in this whole other sort of little understood, preliminary rapid appeal to the Supreme Court. If it were an injunction issued against the president, then we would end up in the court of appeals, very possibly the Ninth Circuit, if it's a California case.
You're sounding
case,
a lot like Trump
I'm
here.
Sounding like Trump.
Yeah.
The Ninth Circuit could.
Without the sing song.
Could well. I'm sounding a little sing song.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Ninth Circuit could very well agree with the injunction and say the president couldn't move forward. Then it would go on these emergency basis, not even dealing with the merits of the case, to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court might, I don't know what they would do.
You don't think they would say to the president has the power?
On an emergency, I don't know if they would say it right off the bat without having held a hearing. Maybe they would say, okay, we got to hear this case really fast and expedite it, census.
Yeah, it's tough to think that they could find a real emergency when just this morning I think the news was that there are 58 former security officials from both Republican and Democratic administrations who've signed on to something that they've presented that says there's no emergency. It's also tough to believe they could find a real emergency when for the last 2 years nothing happened, and then nothing happened from the time, the idea of an emergency came up in, November?
But the statute doesn't have any, requirements for what an emergency might be. So, I mean, I agree with you as a matter of just logic.
And facts.
And facts. But I think as a matter of law, I think he could get this through and by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, as a matter of law, the Supreme Court doesn't want to second guess
what
is an emergency.
We have a
that's
listener
for the president to decide.
A listener in Clayton writes, Bob says, he writes, when the courts consider the emergency declaration, will they take into account data showing whether the border emergency is real, or will they only consider whether the declaration violates the law?
You mean the idea that border crossings, according to the agencies that monitor this stuff, are at a 40-year low?
Yeah. The invasion we're talking about.
Who, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I guess
don't think they will.
I guess it will depend upon, what's in the record of the lower court, decision. But I think very much the Supreme Court doesn't want to be looking at competing arguments about data and emergency, and you want to look at what does the emergency order say, is it lawful, and not get into second-guessing the president.
I mean, I think a better way to stop him would be for Congress to do something, but I just don't think there's enough votes in Congress to get
it. Certainly not
that.
To override a veto.
Override, yeah.
There's
exactly.
probably enough votes to get it to a veto, but he just said this morning he's going to veto, and that would require a little more starch in some spines than we've seen.
That gets voted on in the House tomorrow, by the way, that resolution that they've cooked up. We have a new attorney general, William Barr, confirmed. What can we expect from Mr. Barr? Does anyone have any feeling for what we might expect from him? He's been there before.
Well, I think we can expect that he won't be a whole lot different than Sessions. He won't be as big of a target for President Trump as Sessions turned out to be.
Not for a while.
Yeah, right. I mean, he's very conservative on law enforcement issues. I don't think he's got quite the bee in his bonnet about marijuana that Sessions had. But I think we can expect pretty similar things. The biggest, you know, he will face his biggest hurdle right off the bat, probably the biggest hurdle he'll have during whatever time he's attorney general, and that is what part of a Mueller report he will release. And that's going to be a huge controversy. He has said in the confirmation hearings that he will release as much as the law allows him to release. But, you know, it's Justice Department policy. If you don't indict somebody, you don't explain why, even if Comey did in connection with Hillary Clinton.
There's a question as to whether there's even going to be a report. One of the things I've heard recently is it may just be a series of indictments.
That's right. That's right, because Congress reacted pretty harshly to the depth and detail of the Clinton report and passed a statute that allows the special counsel here to just say yay on a page of indictments and nay on a page of indictments, and that's it.
And that's the end of it.
So,
well, we're not going to get that anything this week. A lot of people were speculating it was going to happen this week. That apparently is not going to be the case. One other thing before we take a break I'd like to spend a little time discussing is the president's former personal lawyer, Mr. Cohen, will be testifying before Congress this week on Wednesday, and we're going to be carrying that here. NPR will be all day, as I understand it. Okay, the president's personal attorney. Obviously, they've had many conversations on legal issues. Where does the client privilege issue come into play here? What can he say, or can he just waive that before anybody?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for one thing, with respect to the Stormy Daniels payments, Trump has said he's not my lawyer. So if Trump says he's not my lawyer, Trump is the one who has the privilege. The client always has the privilege. If he says he's not my lawyer, then there isn't a privilege. So whatever Cohen says or doesn't say to Congress or anybody else about Stormy Daniels, it doesn't implicate an attorney-client privilege that doesn't exist and wasn't asserted. On the other issues that may arise where he may actually have had an attorney-client relationship with the president, I mean, those attorney-client privileges they are not absolute. There's a crime fraud exception. So if you, as the client, direct your lawyer to commit a crime, you can't claim that direction that you gave is privileged. A court can say, no, it's not. And then there's a sort of a third, more arcane area that my husband clued me into, and he does criminal defense work, and that is that when prosecutors want to take a look at matters, documents, emails, whatever, that might implicate an attorney-client privilege, they send in a special group of U.S. attorneys who are separate from the actual attorneys who will prosecute the claim. They look at documents, they look at emails, they make a preliminary decision whether they are privileged. That decision is reviewed by a judge looking at the documents in camera, and then with those two layers of protection, the documents may or may not be released to the prosecutors.
And that's what happened in the Second Circuit, right? I think they found like, what, seven or eight of them
court.
Were
yeah,
privileged, and then they said...
Right, that was the taint group.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
Can we assume that all of this is, this procedure, this process has gone through in conversations with Robert Mueller?
Well, the Cohen thing, Mueller spun off to Southern District of New York.
Right.
So they're doing the investigation. This is very different from the Clinton, the Starr investigation, where they kept just giving him more and more responsibility. Mueller's stayed like laser focused and spun things off. The other thing with the attorney-client privilege is if, you know, Bill's my client and I'm his attorney and we're talking, but then we bring you into the room, that could also breach the privilege, having a third party. Not always, but a lot of times. And it sounds like, and also, I think it's important to remember, you know, you don't just have an attorney that's your attorney for everything and every conversation we have. You know, if Bill's retained me to talk about, you know, his Ponzi scheme he set up, but then on the way out tells me, and yeah, it got me so upset that I just, you know, beat up my neighbor. Well, that's not, the beat up your neighbor's not protected because that's a different crime. It's outside the Ponzi scheme we're working on.
So basically,
which is probably crime fraud.
I'm not entirely sure about that.
Well, you're a good lawyer. You're going to extend the
privilege.
I think
if Bill told you on the way out, I'm going to go do grievous bodily harm to my neighbor,
then you'd have to tell.
That would not be privileged.
And to bring it back to this situation, I think that there's no privilege if a person is asking a lawyer to commit a crime.
Right.
So if Trump is saying something to Cohen about don't tell him how long we were negotiating about that Trump Tower in Moscow, telling Congress to lying to Congress is a crime. It would not be privileged.
I'm confused now. Has Cohen talked to Mueller, or is that totally off the
yes,
table?
Cohen has talked to Mueller.
Yeah. Right. I think he's talked to Mueller. He's talked to the Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office, and now he's supposed to talk to Congress. In a confidential setting.
Yeah. It's going to be public on Wednesday, but there are two other sessions scheduled that are
Tuesday, Thursday are confidential, right?
Yeah.
And then Wednesday.
Wednesday's
open.
That's
right, yeah. Okay, I've got to take a break. Let's do that now. We'll come back and talk about some local issues that are making news these days, and that will be in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back to our conversation with our attorney friends, Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Donna Harper. Guys, we have a whole bunch of things here that have popped up during the last month concerning associated with criminal justice reform, fine, fees, bail, and that sort of thing. I'll go through a list of them and we can discuss them as I do. First thing, Bill, you and I have had two conversations recently about the Supreme Court ruling on forfeiture. Basically dealing with the prohibition on excessive fines, that it applies to states. Not much impact in the civil asset forfeiture realm, which you've been writing about and which we have talked about for now, but it could come back here in Missouri, could have an impact here in Missouri.
It could. So the Supreme Court said that states have to abide by the part of the Eighth Amendment of the Bill of Rights that says you can't have excessive fines. And most states, already were following the excessive fines a part of the Eighth Amendment. So it didn't have a direct effect on Missouri, for example. But it ended up having a pretty significant practical effect because. The day after the Supreme Court decision, which was, I think, the decision was last Wednesday, and the next day the committee of the Missouri House that was chaired by Shamed Dogan passed a bill that would put a big restriction on how civil asset forfeiture is conducted in the state of Missouri. They basically cut off. So in the state of Missouri, about $5 million of the $9 million that police seize on highways around the state doesn't go to the schools like state law would say it should. But instead, they send it through a federal workaround that comes back to the police departments to spend on their own purposes. Phelps County down where Raleigh is has about $2 million a year of this. St. Charles County about $3 million a year of this. This is what we've been writing about. Well, Dogan's bill that passed his committee in the House, and he thinks has a pretty good chance to pass the House, would say you can't St. Charles County, Phelps County, you can't do that anymore. You can't send it to the feds and get it out from under all the restrictions that state law puts on it. So, in those $5 million of cases, the people who are stopped are never charged with a fine, with a crime. So it would shut off that whole $5 million avenue of funding for a couple of police departments. So if that passes the legislature, there will actually be a very significant effect in Missouri.
Yeah, there is something of a trend going on here in Missouri and other states too, as you've indicated. Let me quickly go through these. The Chief Justice of Missouri's highest court, the Supreme Court, has announced plans to restrict courts from charging defendants bail as a condition of their release before trial. This will go into effect on July 1st. The Missouri Supreme Court is considering cases eliminating debtors' prisons. We also talked about that. Inmates charged for room and board, but they can't pay, so they go back to jail where the bill just goes higher. Kim Gardner here, circuit attorney in St. Louis, will not demand cash bail for low-level felonies. It seems to me, Donna, like this is something like a wave.
Seems to me to be a wave, and it seems to me to be just a recognition of the fact that we're putting people in prison or in jail, holding them. They cause them to lose their jobs. Their families fall apart. They can't pay their rent. They can't pay their mortgages. It's destroying communities, and these aren't violent felons. These are people who are charged sometimes with just misdemeanor offenses that have nothing to do with real public safety. I mean, the case of the person who couldn't pay his taxi cab bill and was held in jail for 6 months and then got out and didn't make it back to one of his hearings and got thrown back in jail, and the fines are starting all over again. That doesn't seem to be what the system is designed to do.
And they're charged room and board, sometimes thousands of dollars when all of this happens.
Yeah, these board bills that Tony Messenger, the Post-Dispatch, has been writing about, and that one of these court cases involves, are just outrageous. You know, putting people in jail for not being able to pay for the last time that they were put in jail. It's just ridiculous. You know, all of this is really an outgrowth. I mean, it's a reaction to Ferguson.
Right. Yeah. And I think in a larger, it's just part of that ebb and flow. You know, in the 80s, everyone was getting tough on crime. We had three strikes and you're out. We were putting more people in jail and because we've got to do something about this crime. And now we're taking this look, boy, we've got more people in prison than anyone else, any other country. Mm-hmm. Or most other countries, and we've got all these poor people, and Ferguson and forward through Ferguson, I think, put that in real crystal form, that we're putting people in jail not for crimes, but because they just don't have money, and that's like out of a Charles Dickens novel. We shouldn't be doing that. So trying, and then we talked about this a few weeks ago, just trying to find less crimes that where you have to go to jail. It just doesn't make sense.
That's that whole mandatory minimum movement that started back in the late 70s and through the 80s. And that, too, I think people are rethinking, thank God, because I think the point of the mandatory minimums was they wanted uniform sentencing across jurisdiction. Well, that never really happened. So
this whole issue of criminal justice reform really is getting some traction. There's no question. There's a lot more conversation about things like this.
And conservatives are starting to see.
Right.
I mean, the liberals, I think, have already been a little more, but the conservatives are starting to say, boy, we're spending a lot of our government dollars keeping people in jail. Maybe we don't want to, have so many taxes going to that.
And we're running out of room. We've already run out of room in these places. Any other thoughts? Other things that along these lines that I wanted to mention, various Missouri legislative actions, including such things as parole hearings for people who have lifetime prison terms or serving them, eliminate the mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent offenders. That's getting some discussion in Jefferson City. And again, Kim Gardner in the City Circuit Attorney's Office is expanding her diversion programs to help keep people out of jail. And that, too, is something that's getting a lot of attention, Don. I'm sure that you're well aware of that and probably in favor of it.
And in favor of it, yes. I think anything we can do to keep people out of being incarcerated at our expense and having their lives destroyed for nonviolent offenses makes sense. You know, that sort of makes me think about all the people who are in prison in Missouri for pot, for marijuana, and now it's legal all over the country. But we've got people in prison in Missouri for sometimes for life sentences because it was their third strike. It seems to me to be onerous and unworthy of us as a society that we keep people in prison for things like that.
And it is one area where conservatives and liberals can join together and agree and actually take steps that are successful. You know, that first step bill that Congress passed right around Christmas, right around the holidays. That was Grassley together with Durbin. It was a very bipartisan. I just hope it on this bail thing. I hope we really get it done this time. I have the recollection that I wrote a big series of stories in the early 1970s. It resulted in Missouri Supreme Court reform. It resulted in a bill that passed the Missouri legislature. Kit Bond sent me the pen that he signed the legislation with. But did it do anything? I don't think it did.
Well, we've got a very conservative legislature, so we'll see how it plays out with the...
So maybe you should write some more stories.
Yeah, right. I guess so.
I'll send you a pen.
If it was the early 70s, it's only been like 45 years. Yeah. So you're due for another round.
Oh, yeah, well, impatient. You're being very impatient, Bill. Okay, you heard in the headlines there with regard to the abortion issue and the fact that we're back to this admitting privileges thing again. Well, there were a couple of things going on here. The Missouri Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, stopped Louisiana from enforcing new regulations on abortion. The justices said by 5-4 vote that they will not allow the state to put into effect a law that requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges. So here we are, upholding it on the one hand, and the U.S. Supreme Court is denying it on the other.
Yeah, I'll be interested in reading that district court opinion that you just reported in the headlines to see how they came up with that, because
it sounds a lot like Whole Women's Health, doesn't it?
I mean, it's exactly so a couple of years ago in a Texas case, as the Supreme Court with Justice Kennedy writing the opinion, said that states could not impose requirements that a person have admitting privileges at a hospital within X number of miles. And that was a 5-3 decision, as I recall. And so then a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court said, hey, Louisiana, Louisiana had passed a law similar to Texas's and said you got to have admitting privileges. And the law had been put on hold, and the Supreme Court, with Justice Roberts joining the four Democratic appointed justices to make five, said this law cannot be enforced. So how in the world a Missouri federal judge come around to decide, oh yeah, we're going to let Missouri's law be enforced? I don't know exactly what the distinction would be.
Roberts, as you indicated, has sided with the liberal group in the Supreme Court. Does this ruling on the Louisiana case give us a peek into what the court might be doing if other abortion issues come before the court?
This is what I think. I mean, what do I know? But Roberts, I mean, this is just to slow things down, and I don't think this means that Roberts has suddenly switched sides or anything. I think when it gets to the Supreme Court, he'll want to have a full hearing. I don't think they're going to overturn Roe versus Wade, but I think they're going to start finding all of these things, all these little legislative hurdles that are put up. They're going to say they're no longer a substantial burden. We don't find them to be a substantial burden. And so while they won't overturn Roe versus Wade, they'll gut Roe versus Wade that way. And it'll be a slow, gradual process.
I think that may be true. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts did. It's sort of an insight into his thinking. I mean, the most important thing to Chief Justice Roberts, who's going to be Chief Justice of this court for another two decades, assuming he has good health, is that this Supreme Court have legitimacy. If it looks like just Trump appointing a couple of people changes all sorts of decisions, it looks like a court that just is based on political decisions. So he doesn't want that to happen. Roberts was in the dissent, in the minority in the Texas case we were talking about admitting privileges. So he thought in that case on the merits that the states could adopt those kinds of rules. But then he just, I think, after Gorsuch and, I mean, he didn't explain this. This is just reading the tea leaves. After Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, I think he just felt as though it would really look bad if the Supreme Court just started dismantling Roe versus Wade right off the bat.
He's thinking legacy.
He's thinking legacy.
Everyone,
and also, I think, legitimate concern for the institution of the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
and its legitimacy.
We'll have another insight into. There's a case that's been passed on from conference to conference to conference. The conferences are when they decide whether to, the Supreme Court justices decide whether to hear a case on an Indiana law. That regulates how fetal body parts can be disposed, and it also says you can't have an abortion if they're up for a genetic abnormality. Pence signed it when he was governor. And the courts, federal courts, have said that law cannot go into effect. So it's sort of in the same position as the Louisiana law was. And so if Roberts in that case, which he's clearly not, is having trouble deciding what to do, if he in that case lets that law go into effect, then, it's going to be hard to tell where things are going.
Yeah. I'll just mention this and comment if you think it's worth commenting on. The Missouri Supreme Court has rejected a suit by a woman challenging the state's abortion law, Missouri, of course. She claimed on religious grounds that she should not be subjected to Missouri's 72-hour waiting period or informed consent law, which was involved reading a pamphlet of some sort
talked about life beginning at conception, and she said that was contrary to her religious views.
So that was rejected. Here we go again with the...
that was an easy one for the Missouri Supreme Court. That wasn't going to ever go anywhere. I mean, the decision, they point out that she didn't explain why a 72-hour waiting period violated her religious beliefs.
She just said that she had to travel to and from. That's not a religious issue. Yeah.
And what was her religious affiliation? It was sort of weird, wasn't it?
A Satanist of some type.
Yeah, okay.
And the other thing is she got to have the abortion, so I think that the court just said, 72 hours, who cares?
I think her pregnancy was in 2015, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
Okay, let's take another break. Time is moving along so quickly. We'll continue our conversation with Legal Roundtable panelists in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with attorneys Donna Harper, Bill Freivogel, and Mark Smith. There are attempts in both houses of the Missouri legislature to cover proposed legislation ostensibly to level the playing field in Title IX collegiate sexual abuse cases. It's designed to offer more protections for the accused. Donna, I know this is something you wanted to talk about. This reminds me of what Betsy DeVos, our education secretary, has been saying, that she's sort of wants to give the accused, generally the male, more protections.
Yeah, I actually sent an email to Senator Romines asking him to help me understand this, and I have yet to receive a response.
He's a sponsor.
He's the sponsor of the bill,
Senate,
right? I mean, the bill as it is written says its purpose is that individuals have the right to defend character. That, to me, sounds like it's a bill written on behalf of people who are accused rather than sort of an even-handed bill. That's what it says right in the statute itself at 173.1898. One of the things that I find really troublesome about this bill is that you'll recall 2 years ago, Governor Greitens in August of 2017 signed into law amendments to the Missouri Human Rights Act. And when he signed those into law, he took away any liability for individuals who violated the employment discrimination statutes. So sexual harassers, people who are who hang nooses on other employees' lockers, no individual liability. Now, fast forward a year and a half later, and now they are instating individual liability for anybody who works at a college or university who's involved in any of these investigations. If you believe you have not gotten due process from that person, the individual who believes he hasn't gotten due process can sue the individual university administrator, but you can't sue the person who actually did the wrong thing to you if you're an employee. I just find that two-faced. I don't even know. It takes my breath away.
Also, if I understand the bill correctly, it allows the person who is if it's believed that the complaint, usually by the woman, is false, the accused can seek actual or punitive damages from her.
Punitive damages are a big deal.
And and the school who is conducting the investigation. And these things aren't criminal and they aren't civil. Mm-hmm. This is a school deciding, how do we want our campus to be run? Mm-hmm. How do we want, what message do we want to send? Who do we want to support here? The school can be sued for breach of contract up to $250,000. Mm-hmm. If the school suspends somebody who is accused of date rape, for instance, or drugging somebody's drinks, or any kind of sexual assault. There's also, before the school can find violation, this statute says that the legal standard for that is clear and convincing evidence, which is not the standard in most civil actions. It's preponderance of the evidence. It's not clear and convincing. That's one of the highest standards you can get. So you can't even find, a school can't even believe, in most cases, the woman who says, this is what happened and I didn't give consent, unless there's clear and convincing evidence. And, you know, in a one-on-one situation, when is there ever going to be clear and convincing evidence?
What's behind all of this?
Betsy DeVos.
Betsy DeVos.
I mean, this is Missouri passed or is proposing this law. Arizona proposed a similar law. You know, DeVos has proposed all these regulations, and there was the notice and comment period. So I know a lot of our students at WashU were commenting, and some administrators commented, but they don't have to accept those comments. And I think, you know, as Donna said, this is a complicated area of the law because you have these events that happen, and the law comes at it in a lot of different ways. One way is through the criminal process. So a survivor, which, by the way, in this Senate bill, you couldn't call yourself a survivor, but you'd have to call yourself the complainant. But the survivor could bring a criminal action. Oftentimes, for a variety of reasons, they choose not to do that. And then you can, under Title IX, come to the university saying, this event happened towards me, and it's affecting my educational experience based on my sex. I was attacked based on my sex, and because of that, and seeing my assailant on campus, I can't get an education here. So that's a Title IX, much like a Title VII hostile work environment or something. And then you also have, as Donna said, universities which say to their students, we have certain standards that we enforce as a student of this community that we expect you to adhere to. And so universities want to have a right to enforce those standards as well. And then you get issues of like burden of proof. Clearly on a criminal case, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. But on Title IX, which is more like a civil thing, it would be preponderance, but now they're going back to these higher levels. And then what does the university have to do in terms of enforcing their particular rules? So it's very complicated. Plus, as somebody who works with undergrads every day, you know, oftentimes, I'm not saying always, but oftentimes these cases involve, you know, two 19-year-olds who are drinking, who've drank way too much, who have not been sexually active before, and don't know, and they're both, maybe the one's blacked out, maybe they're both blacked out, and something happens, and it's traumatizing, and then somebody's got to deal with it. It's very difficult.
I mean, the bottom line is it makes it a lot harder it's already hard for a victim of sexual assault to stand up and make a complaint, and this just makes it harder. It puts all sorts of possible adverse consequences on her.
And it puts a lot of burdens on these universities. Every one of these universities that gets Title IX money has procedures in place, and they have been trying more or less effectively, depending on what institution you're talking about, to protect students and provide an environment where everyone can get an education. Now, the school officials are going to have to, if this bill passes, the school officials who make decisions in the context of complaints by students against other students are supposed to disclose their prejudicial beliefs or previous experience that may be actual bias or that might be perceived as bias. So what does that mean? That they have an investigator who's looked into 10 of these complaints and found that in 9 of them, something awful happened and the perpetrator needs to leave the school. Is that the a prejudicial previous experience that might be perceived bias? They got to fire the investigator who finds that? I mean, what is this all about?
Who writes this stuff?
Romines.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, anything you want to add in that, or shall we move on?
Don, I'd like him to write me back on my email.
Well, maybe he's listening.
I hope so.
Okay, let's move on to something else. Missouri lawmakers moving to take the sun out of the sunshine law, making it more difficult to access public records. Bill, I'm going to toss that your way because you're the journalist attorney here, and I know this strikes you at your core.
Yes. I mean, what's amazing about this is that 62% of the voters passed I think it was Proposition 1.
Amendment 1.
Constitutional amendment that opened up the, you know, the records of state legislators. And then the state legislators are saying, oh, we're so worried about our constituents. We want to protect them. That we're going to do the opposite. We're going to close up those records. I mean, for one thing, I mean, what about the sort of basic, constitutional law tenet that you can't pass legislation or a House rule or something that's contradictory to a part of the Constitution. And more broadly, I mean, the Missouri legislature is just, time after time after time undoing the votes of large majorities of the Missouri voters, you know, whether it's concealed carry, whether it's right to work, whether it's minimum wage, whether it's reapportionment, whether it's the Sunshine Law, they just think they can ignore what a majority of the voters say. And as long as the majority of the voters let them do that, you know, they're going to be stuck with legislators who don't listen to them.
They really seem particularly upset with Amendment 1. I mean, as you've indicated, there are a number of avenues they're taking to try to undo what the voters have done.
But like Bill said, I mean, this is just dumb because you can't overturn as soon as the statute gets passed, somebody's going to challenge it, saying it's unconstitutional. I don't even know what they're thinking here. I just don't get that.
Well, it takes
There's only
ahead,
one lawyer left in the legislature.
Really?
That's what I heard. I don't know if it's true.
I don't know either.
Only one lawyer left.
So, yeah, somebody told me that there's only one lawyer left in the legislature.
Maybe it just seems that way.
Well, you know, maybe. Richard III said, first thing we do is kill all the lawyers, and that's because he wanted to eliminate the rule of law. So I know people sometimes hate lawyers, but we're kind of good at following the rule of law most of the time. So.
Well, some of my best friends are lawyers.
We appreciate the fact that you...
move on to something else as the clock begins to tick a little more rapidly. The exclusion list. Judge here tossed a temporary restraining order sought by St. Louis Police Union attorneys to block the release of a so-called exclusion list of officers who were banned from bringing in cases for prosecution, obviously here in the city of St. Louis. The judge also blocked a union attempt to question an official in the circuit attorney Kimberly Gardner's office about creation of this list. Why are they seeking to block the release of the list? Do we know?
Well, I guess they don't want the names of these 25 of these police officers
to
become
public.
They say it's going to hurt their reputation.
Yeah, that it's somehow. But, God, the St. Louis Police Department could not be doing a worse job of supporting this lawsuit. I mean, there was the case last week where the police officers stole somebody's phone. So this person is being booked and this cop comes by and just takes the phone. And it's, you know, and those station houses are all camered up. And it's just stupid. And so, and then all the other stuff that's been in the news. I mean, I think this is they got Selzer to back them, but Court of Appeals said no way. And I think they're not going to be able to block this. And it's already starting to leak out is what I hear, so.
Yeah, I'm pretty certain that the number of attorneys in town have that list and can use that effectively in their defense, right?
Criminal defense lawyers, I'm sure some of them have it.
Yeah.
And
that's really upsets the apple cart when they have that list when it comes to prosecution, doesn't it?
I would think so.
Yeah. Well, time again, marching away. I wanted to bring up something that we had not indicated earlier that we might want to be talking about, but Bill brought it to my attention this morning, and that is that Clarence Thomas wants to revisit the New York Times versus Sullivan ruling on libel and defamation. That's the 1964 opinion holding that public officials have a higher burden to prove libel. Again, back to you, Bill, on Justice Thomas's effort here, apparent effort.
Yeah, well, I guess I think he won't, in the end, be successful. New York Times versus Sullivan is like, one, along with Pentagon Papers, you know, is like one of the most important precedents for media and the press. It was also really important. It's interesting that Justice Thomas takes this view because it was an incredibly important civil rights decision in a way. Because at the time of New York Times versus Sullivan, Southern segregationist officials, like Sullivan, had won $5 million in judgments against the New York Times and $1.5 million in judgments against CBS. They were trying to get the news media out of the South because they knew they were losing on segregation because of the stories and the TV pictures of police dogs attacking civil rights lawyers, civil rights protesters and the like. And it was just a way for them to try to kill the civil rights movement. And the Supreme Court saw that and said, you know, we've got to have, I mean, the phrase that Justice Brennan used was, we've got to have, democracy needs breathing room. And so if an ad in the New York Times misstated the number of times Martin Luther King had been arrested and said it was 7 instead of 5, no big deal. That's not going to be something that a public official who hasn't even been named in the ad can collect on. You know, the thing that sort of followed up the Clarence Thomas deal, though, is that, you know, we have this $250 million lawsuit against the Washington Post for their coverage of that young man from Covington, Kentucky, who was on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in a face-off.
Friend of the Native
Nick
American.
Sandman.
Right,
yeah.
Nick Sandman, yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's a pretty threatening case for the media. The person who's brought the case represented Richard Jewell, who you'll remember was the falsely accused
Atlanta
bombing suspect, who had actually had found the bomb and alerted people. So he's not, you know, he's a serious lawyer, and it is, you know, I do think as a journalist, I do think that the media, I mean, the media's really got to be careful, like jumping on these viral videos before they know what's going on. You know, this viral video came from, I think it was from a Twitter site. You know, people haven't even pinned down who the source of it was, and it did lead to some very misleading initial impressions. And I don't think that the media in general was careful enough in giving it that story some time to breathe.
Well, look at the Smollett case. The actor is exactly the same thing.
Both are the same thing. Yeah, and it's the hazards of today's media. I was thinking about this Lincoln Memorial case. I mean, 20 years ago, that story would not have happened. There wouldn't have been even if there were a reporter there, there wouldn't have been a film crew. Nobody would have seen the standoff. If somebody had gone into a newsroom and said, "Hey, I saw this happen," nobody would have written a story. This is a story that, you know, now a whole nation knows about that no one would have known about before.
Now we've all got cell phones.
Yeah.
We can take those pictures. Donna, did you want to
say? Wanted to say one thing. I mean, I completely agree with Bill that I think that the Sullivan case is going to stand the test of time. And one just tiny little fact about it, that was a 9-0 unanimous decision. I mean, I think our Supreme Court now would be hard-pressed to chip away at or reverse the Sullivan case. It stood the test of time.
Very quickly, we only have a few seconds left. How do you revisit something like this? You have to wait for a case to come through.
You'd have to wait for a case to come up. And then you could say, you know, it was wrongly decided. But Chief Justice William Rehnquist, you know, the very conservative former Chief Justice, who was originally a skeptic on New York Times versus Sullivan, he finally, before he died, embraced it.
All right. have to let it go at that. A very fast hour. Lady and gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. Donna, great to see you again. Bill Freivogel and Mark Smith, as always, good to see you. We'll see you in about a month. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, honoring Arbor Day on April 26th, with an ongoing commitment to sustainable stewardship and conservation of Missouri's forests. ChooseWood.com.